Do you ever wonder where all your money went? Like every single time you look at your bank account? Honestly, it's probably all those subscriptions. I felt that way too, until I got Rocket Money. Rocket Money helped me see all the subscriptions I'm paying for, and it was eye-opening. Between streaming services, fitness apps, delivery services, it all adds up so quickly. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year, with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code AUDIO to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code AUDIO at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code AUDIO.
Hey, welcome to another episode of Seth Off Air, where I get to talk to guests away from my desk at Studio HE. Today, John Mulaney came in, and we had such a long, interesting conversation that we decided to make it the entire episode. He is one of my favorite people in the world, and I don't think I'm alone in saying that, so please enjoy me and John Mulaney just talking about stuff. And we're here with John Mulaney.
Hi, Seth.
How are you?
I'm very good.
First of all, I think it's your Nana's birthday.
You know, it just was.
Okay.
But with her, with that force of life, I think it's her birth week. You know?
Sure.
So she gets a week, and she is, I don't know, do you say people's age?
I don't know. It's up. It's your Nana, I think.
93.
Yeah, I think at that point, it becomes just impressive.
Yeah, because her 90th was a big deal.
She
rented a bus and had a microphone and a speaker and gave us a tour of Salem and all the different memories she had.
How many people on the bus?
Her family, who all knew her and the places, like a solid 12 to 15 people.
And how long was the bus ride?
It was probably like an hour and a half, 2 hours.
New stories or ones everyone had heard?
New stories and my favorite types of stories, which are not like beginning, middle, and end. I really like those more.
Yeah.
Like that's where Artie Dickinson pushed my brother into the pond. And then, you know, there's no like, and then he went on to this. And some of her stories are a lot like that, but it was just a, like, that was a bar that had pizza and you couldn't get pizza unless you went into the bar. And my father was a congressman. And we had congressional plates, and I drove to the bar to get pizza because no one else had pizza. And I got pizza.
That's great.
It's great.
We've talked about this on the show, but I'm assuming your Nana has an incredible memory.
Yes.
Because she figured out that my mother and her were in a production of Pills of Poppin' in Marblehead, Massachusetts.
Which you and I now say like it's a real production everyone knows.
Right.
But it was a specialty show.
Yeah. I think a one-off.
I think a one-off, maybe a weekend, to raise money for the hospital in Marblehead.
Yeah. But it's so strange because my mother is not sort of famously my mother. I don't know how your grandmother figured it out because basically one day you came to SNL and said my grandmother figured out that your mother and her did a show together.
And it was pretty, I don't know where she saw your mother's maiden name Osborne connected to you, but it was immediate.
Yeah.
And it wasn't like it, maybe
right.
There's a difference.
It was a different last name, so there was no...
Oh, no.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, there was maybe a profile in the Globe or something. I don't know.
Did you? Maybe that was it. But I know you to have one of the best memories of anyone. One of my favorite things about hanging out with you, other than that I love you very much, is you remember things from our shared history at a much greater detail than I feel like I do. So sometimes I'm treated to stories that I had already forgotten that I was there for.
Oh, I do enjoy having a good memory, and it's I'm very glad you appreciate it. I'm lately now trying to not hold back out of discretion, but just, like, if someone tells an anecdote a little wrong. Like, last night, we were at dinner, as Seth knows, and someone told something just a little off, and I feel like there was a time where I might have been like, no, he walked in and he was in a blue shirt. And then he said,
I feel like I know the story. Was it a birthday based story?
It was a birthday
based
story.
Yeah, okay. I know exactly what you're talking about.
And there was a coda to the story that I could not believe was included. And I watched the whole table move on.
Yeah.
And I truly was about to go, wait a second, everyone forgot the best part of the story, and I didn't. Yeah. I'm trying to go with the flow and not do that.
We had a wonderful dinner last night because Will Forte and Jason Sudeikis were on last night doing John Bovey.
Yes.
And Will lives in L.A., and every time we did it when Andy Samberg came back, we try very hard to have dinners with our era of the show.
And I hadn't seen Will in a while.
Yeah, it's been a really long time.
Yeah. And Jason was out in L.A. for the better part of a year.
And it's really nice because we are officially now about a decade removed from the heyday of that time.
Yeah, our heyday.
Yeah. No, for the heyday of our shared friendship.
Between us?
Yeah. It was a heyday. Everybody knows it was a heyday.
You know, come on. Anthony Weiner, you know, all the great stories.
Oh, Anthony Weiner. You were 08, first that fall, September 08?
Auditioned August 7th, 2008.
Wow.
And then same day that Bernie Brillstein passed away.
Is that why you remember, or is it
no,
your memory?
I remember it because of me and my life.
Yeah.
But I went home. No, I didn't go home. I went to the hotel that the good people at Saturday Night Live provided those auditioning because they did not know I had an apartment and lived in New York.
Got it.
But they offered a hotel, so I took it. And I went home and I saw on, I don't know, Internet Explorer or Safari, choose your poison, that Bernie Brillstein had passed away, who was Lorne Michaels' manager and a huge part of the show.
Then do you remember what day I called you?
Yes. So that was a Thursday. Well, you know, someone could look this up and get it wrong. I feel like on Tuesday, I didn't audition on a Friday. Yeah, it was a Thursday. So on Tuesday, I believe, I was in Chicago and you called me and I was at a restaurant called Sapori.
Gotcha.
On Halsted. And I stepped outside the restaurant because it was a 212 number. Which, you know, that stopped me cold at that age.
Yeah.
And it was you. And you said, do you want to be a writer? And I said, yes. And you said, I just need to be clear, it is just writing. And I was like, oh, mutually agreed upon.
I was in Montreal when I called you.
Oh, you
so
were?
I remember where I was. I was on a trip with Klein, Jost, Kenward, and Simon.
The hot tub trip?
What was the hot tub trip?
No, that you were all looking for Jost? Because you'd been at a spa for a long time.
Oh, yeah, that trip.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he wasn't doing anything bad in the hot tub, listeners. He was just, they were all dressed and ready to go to dinner, and then they looked through a glass window, and he was still in an outdoor hot tub.
Yes. We had, we went to this beautiful spa in Montreal. We had this reservation, and a very hard-to-get reservation. And I said, everybody's got to be back.
Oh, like a nice French.
Yes.
Yeah.
We got to leave the spa at 6. And it was like The Glass and The Graduate.
Right.
Like, we were banging on glass and watching our friend, who is famously not in a rush.
It should be famous.
He always has the air of a man in a hot tub.
Hey,
and
what's
this
up?
Was the first time he was actually in.
I recall he lost his phone, and it was 11:25, and the Saturday Night Live TV show starts at 11:30, and everyone was looking for him, and he just came into the cue card area and went, hey, what's up? Was that the trip he fell asleep in a cemetery? Or is that folklore?
That was Helsinki. He fell asleep in a cemetery in Helsinki.
It's like a Lou Reed lyric.
Yeah. And then he not only did he fall asleep in a cemetery, Jost carried around a notebook over to write down sketch ideas. And he showed us.
I mean, that's the most professional part of the story.
Yeah, but he showed us what he had written in the cemetery, and it was for real, like, True Detective just squirrels.
Oh, wow.
Like, he had been in a place mentally to open up a book, take out a pen.
He'd been in the Bardo.
Yeah. Just, like, do hear some squirrels.
Any of it usable?
Yeah. It was Manny Manimal. That's what. Yeah.
And then I would be remiss to not mention that he fell asleep on a hamburger.
Yeah.
Yeah. Using the bun on his cheek.
Yeah.
If you've ever seen the movie poster for Dan in real life.
Yes, but insert
insert a burger and underneath
and
Steve
and a truly asleep person. Yeah.
Oh, so I was in Montreal, but I remember the only three I remember where I was, because I don't feel like my memory is as good as you, but I was in Montreal when I called you. I was in New Mexico when I called Mike O'Brien.
Oh, yeah.
And I was in my apartment when I called Taryn Killam. I didn't get to call a lot of the people, but those were ones I remember.
How did that shake out? Like, sometimes?
Yeah. You know, we'd split it up. If someone else knew the person better, they would call.
Because it was, like, a fun...
It was the best.
Yeah. Oh, that's great.
And I think Lauren always liked me to call people that we had hired via auditions.
And a call from him, having not met him, would have been, I would have not believed it was him.
Right. I don't know if he's ever called anyone.
Yeah, I don't think he's ever called anyone.
Yeah. I mean, I think now.
Like dialed? And, yeah, I actually.
When was
I started
last
off time? Joking, but I feel like you get a call and it's like, can you call Lauren?
Yeah.
And you're like, yeah.
Or you get a call that says Lauren's going to call. You know, like
yes, call.
Like he doesn't want to make a call on whether or not to leave a voicemail.
He doesn't want to experience a voicemail outgoing message to a degree you can't imagine.
Yeah.
Are you free for the next few days?
That's
yeah.
The
will you be by your
level.
Phone? Absolutely.
Imagine that level of success to never have to hear an outgoing voicemail message.
Absolutely.
Fantastic.
Can't imagine. There's people who leave no paper trail, but I don't think there's a single recorded message from him anywhere.
Yeah. We wrote a lot together, but you wrote your most sketches with Simon and Merrick.
My most sketches. Yeah.
I think I said that
no, I
perfectly.
Think, yeah.
Yeah.
My schedule, if you could dignify what I did with that word, was Monday night, write with Simon, Rich, and Merrick Sawyer. Tuesday afternoon, polish with them. Then I'd go work with Bill Hader around 4 or 5 till 10, 11. 11 p.m. to 2 a.m., possibly 5 a.m., back with Simon and Merrick, because we would then debate everything we'd agreed upon earlier and the day before.
Yeah.
And then I'd take a nap, and then 9 a.m., you'd be up?
Yeah.
You'd take a short nap, too.
Mm-hmm.
Then I'd come into your office, and Mike Shoemaker would bring you bagels, and then I would sit in there and try to help on whatever.
Yeah.
Because you always had to write, like, a cold open. You had to write the bones of the show a lot.
Yeah.
And so it was like, no one wrote anything about the State of the Union and the fact that the president was kidnapped or something. So you'd have to bang it out.
I was so happy when you showed up, because those mornings for me felt like clutter, like just a cluttered desktop of open documents that, and try to figure out how to finish them and where they would go. And it was, you came in to help unclutter, and that was, I enjoyed those hours.
I just wanted to cheerlead the morning, and I didn't want to go home. I went home one time, and I lived in Brooklyn, and when I was trying to get to the office, there was a ship going through a goddamn river or something, and so the bridge was up. I thought I would be late for read-through. I did not know at the time that read-through starts roughly an hour to 2.5 hours late.
Yeah.
So I never, ever didn't sleep at the office after that.
My first year, I remember about halfway through my first year, that was the last time I slept at home on a Tuesday night for 12 and a half years.
You would always have open the thing you really wanted to write and would write, and then you would have a cold open, I feel like. Did you like writing those?
Yeah. I didn't dislike. There were weeks where I hated it, but I liked that real estate. I also like that, because you have to have a cold open, you could kind of like lay out a first draft in a way that you can't with like a premise sketch. You have to get it perfect for Wednesday, or else nobody's going to say, I think they'll figure it out.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Okay. So Simon and I forgot, would always write a monologue for, I think, 3 years. Because he came to me my second week at the after party, and he said, you and I are going to write a monologue every week, because no one likes writing monologues. And then he poked me in the chest and he went, and you can't cut the monologue. And we did. I think I wrote some with you too, but all in all, it was a rare week that Simon and I didn't write one.
What percentage of those were the monologue in the end?
That's hard to tell, because I don't know if you know this, but things get screwy during the week. So like there were a few, like the pure premise, bones, guts, heart, blood, hair of the monologue thrown out. But then that didn't mean it wasn't your monologue.
Yeah.
It was still yours, which was for us territory and what we thought was power to have the monologue. But yeah, some would be whole cloth thrown out. And that was actually more fun. I felt like a decent monologue that no one checked in on. And then you got to Saturday, we would rehearse it. And I always wanted to go up to the host and go, Yeah, man, I'm sorry.
Well, they...
This was a placeholder, and I've had a busy week.
It's also that the one thing where the host, you know, as with any monologue, they have to feel some connection to it. And so it's very hard on, like, Tuesday and Wednesday.
Except Barkley.
Barkley, right. Barkley will say whatever.
Barkley, we wrote a monologue that did not change and had jokes in it that we intended to take out because Michael Jordan had just gotten remarried. And there was a joke in the read through. He goes, by the way, Michael Jordan just got remarried. Congrats, Mike. That's going to go great. And I remember on air being on the floor and Barkley saying it. I was like, oh, my God, we left that. And then Barkley started laughing. It was, God bless everyone. It's a very funny thing to say on TV.
Yeah.
Congrats, Mike. I bet that's going to go great.
Your monologue, I fully believe, on the Elton John week, saved the show.
That was a Simon and I.
Yes.
Yeah.
And Elton John on Wednesday morning was very, which I don't blame him in any way, shape, or form for, certainly not somebody who'd done a lot of sketch comedy, somebody who had not really risked bombing in 30 years.
No. And also someone who plays arenas.
Yeah.
Which is like, you can never put that down, I don't think.
Yeah.
I mean, he was like, I'm Elton John. And he was. And I say that with all due respect. Like, he was not going to be like, oh, whatever you want. You know?
Yeah. I will say he came into the week with a whatever you want attitude, and then it sort of that went
away. What was that morning like? Because I came in, and there was an air in the air.
Yeah.
And
I
was not
told he wasn't happy with the sketches. And
that means roughly 42 sketches.
42 sketches. That's a lot of sketches. And
he wasn't happy with any of them.
He wasn't happy with any of them. And I, because like no one was around, no one's really around who's in charge.
Right.
At that hour.
Right.
By that hour, I mean like 11 a.m.
11. By that time, I had gone downstairs to buy new underwear at J. Crew.
Right.
That was my one concession to the people sitting near me. I'm not, by the way, folks, my underwear didn't reek, but it made me feel better about myself.
I went in, and I remember saying to him, look, if you don't like anything.
He was wearing a black and white striped Adidas tracksuit.
He was.
Yeah.
And
pants and jacket.
Yeah. And he said, and Elton John glasses. The only way you could describe Elton John's glasses were Elton John
that's
glasses.
That's the thing. There's no offstage glasses.
It's the best.
It's great. I knew by that point, did you ever reach a point where when people were specific and some would say difficult, I would say specific and unique individuals, like that it was almost funny?
Yes.
Because when I came in and I knew he hated everything, I just almost started laughing.
Oh, yeah.
Into the small room where he was sitting in an Adidas tracksuit, like a Tenenbaum, with a stack of 42 sketches, looking very angry.
They might have been Elton John cheaters. Like, they were both Elton John glasses, but there was a little bit of, like, reading.
Yeah,
Elton John reading glasses.
Yeah, that's right. But they had a little, they had buttresses or whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I had to fully lie to him and say, my goal going in there was just to get him at the table.
Oh, was that a risk?
Which
was
part?
That in the air that he might not do the table?
I think it was more just like get him to go to the table enthusiastically. I basically said, look, if you don't like anything, we'll just start over, which you fully know is it's too late.
Absolutely.
Like,
no,
you
lie.
Can't start over.
And after. When I say was that a risk, I don't mean like he would be exceptional. There was sometimes a feeling like people just don't know what to do.
Right.
So they go like, I don't know about any of this.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh, honey, you're doing the show on Saturday.
Yeah.
But they would never threaten it. But it was
right.
just kind of like.
But if anybody could.
He's concerned, you know, and it's like, great.
I think we were all aware that no one needed SNL less than Elton John.
No.
We have the least to offer him as far as this is going to be big
this
for
is
you.
Going to be exposure.
This is the we've taken the long way around to the fact that we then sat down and the first thing he read was the monologue that you and Simon wrote, which had a ton of great jokes.
Oh, it was about he and his husband, David Furnish, had just had their first son.
Yeah.
Levon.
Yeah.
Isn't that amazing?
And there was a joke about rejecting the breast, was that?
Feeding is going all right, though he has rejected the breast, and in that way he takes after both of his fathers. We had the child through a surrogate. David and I cannot conceive children, though we tried as hard as we could.
These were wonderfully delivered.
I thought we wrote funny jokes, but he like sat up and was like Elton John sans piano and like delivered it perfectly.
And it immediately, you could just watch all the stress fall off him.
Oh, really?
Fall off everybody else. And
I was in the back.
It was so, it was that, because again, monologues are such a tricky thing, but that was a Wednesday monologue that was so good. And he realized like, oh yeah, this week's going to be fine. And then the rest of the week was great.
And I came in just to maybe, he was in a Fred as Queen Elizabeth and Bill as Prince Philip sketch. And he needed no direction or information from me on who those people were. But I went, I think I just wanted to see him. And I went into that room and I said, I also wrote a monologue. He goes, I love it. We're not changing a word. I love it. And I was like, great. Thank you. And he goes, I love it. We're not changing a word. As if I was, you know, as if I was one of my great editors. And Betty White. You and I wrote the Betty White monologue.
Yeah.
You had the idea that she thought, now that the campaign had been on Facebook, it was your monologue, and I joined in and loved it. But you had the premise that you know, I didn't even know what Facebook was, and people said that Facebook people want you to host, and now that I do know what it is, God, what an awful waste of time.
those were the ones, though, you know,
that was like Wednesday to Saturday untouched.
Yeah. Because they're, you know, again, the benefit of writing a monologue for people like Betty White or Elton John, who both have a voice everyone knows, including the people who are writing, and this long history that everybody knows, those are the easier monologues than somebody who you have to, like, introduce them to the audience, which is really hard.
Yes. It's become a higher octane thing, the monologue.
Yeah.
You watch a monologue from the 80s, and it's like,
nothing.
So I'm hosting.
Yeah.
Wore a new suit. And people kind of like applaud. And it's like, good, great. And you're just like, what the hell was going on?
I remember John Goodman came out once and did an impression of his newborn baby. And that was it.
Yeah.
He was like, here's what she looks like. And he did a cry face. And everybody thought it was adorable. And then the show started.
Yeah. Like, now in the 70s, like Steve Martin would do. He would do stand-up because he was a very famous stand-up. But like Elliot Gould sang Anything Goes. First he came out, and I remember seeing this on video when I was a little kid. He came out peeling a banana, and I think he hands the banana to someone in the front. There's nothing more 70s than that nonsense. And then he sang Anything Goes, just sang the song. And it was great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that was also, in the 70s, there was this idea that was all reflective of what variety shows had been before SNL. So it was
the very idea of...
Yeah.
Yeah.
A joke about what it was. And now what it is people only know the idea of a monologue for a variety show from SNL.
Right. And I wish the stress could be lowered for people.
Yeah.
But it just has a different wattage for some reason. And also, like, there are things that we do every single week that we also are noted on and beat up on ourselves on, such as naming the project they're in.
Yeah.
And the words, thank you very much. It's great to be here hosting Saturday Night Live, which is actually written out in the script. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Period. Thank you very much. It is great to be here hosting Saturday Night Live. Simon used to say F7. and then, you know, we would try to avoid it, but it was like, some of you may know me from Gossip Girl, and it was like, You just need to land people. Yeah. And every week it was like, oh, they always sound like that. And it was like, they we got to do it.
Oh, yeah. If you take out any of that, it's so jarring.
One of the least important flaws in Harvey Weinstein was that he would call the show every week at any time that there was a host in a film of his, because he used to be a film producer. And he would say, he would ask that we mention the movie. And it was like, yeah. We're gonna. We don't got much. We don't got much on Skeet Ulrich, so we're gonna mention the movie.
We'll mention. It's so funny that kind of that is a thing a producer does. When people say, "What is a producer?" They do stuff like that.
Yeah. Make sure you plug the movie. Oh. We were just gonna go off pure personality, but we'll do. Mention the movie now.
This, although, is great. I was in a Gary Marshall film.
Yes, you were.
New Year's Eve.
Yes, you were.
And Gary Marshall went to Northwestern, where I went to school.
Yes.
And then I was Grand Marshall for our homecoming.
That's just the title that other schools
for all schools, yeah. Right. So it has nothing to do with the Marshall.
But his name, Gary, is almost like Grant.
Well, it's an anagram.
Right. And I defy anyone to prove us wrong. But it's a pure anagram.
He came to introduce me at there was like a ceremony where before you like go in the homecoming parade, you get introduced. And Gary Marshall flew out specifically to do it, which was so sweet.
You'd already done the movie.
I'd done the movie. It hadn't come out.
Oh, wow.
And he went up and he was like, this guy's a great guy. I love this guy. He's in a movie New Year's Eve. It comes out November 11th.
This is one of these guys.
And he finished and then he came off. And as he introduced me, he goes, make sure you tell him what day it comes out. And so even though he'd just done it, he was the kind of guy who'd been in show business so long.
Yeah.
He thought, like, even for just a lawn of 400 college students,
yeah,
he was like,
There's a documentary, I think, called Sitcom. It was like a half-hour documentary that you can find on YouTube about him because he had more Cappy Days, Laverne and Shirley on the air at once. And it's from 1,000 years ago, and it's already like, this is a extremely successful producer who's already proven his might. And then to think, 40 years later, on his like fifth victory lap of still making funny things, he's like, plug the date.
Plug it.
Yeah.
Because in his head, the plugging was part of his success.
Bill Hader and I once had a discussion, only once, about making a feature film involving the character of Stefan. We avoided talking about it because we just avoided talking about it. We just weren't sure about it. But the one thing we were sure about was that the film would be kind of like 24-hour Party People, so like a narrative documentary where he is the correspondent on Saturday Night Live Weekend Update. And the one thing we were sure about was that Lauren would be played by Gary Marshall. And that was non-negotiable.
Well,
and he would say, I'm Lauren Michaels. And I run this town.
The only thing I wanted to have happen in that movie, and maybe it was Bill's idea, was that I wanted in the first scene to agree to go out with Stefan.
Yes.
And then a super fast cut of us at all the clubs.
Yes.
And then I was then zipped into a body bag. And then that would be the opening, and then it would be zipped into a body bag, and then it would pan up to Stefan saying, he's dead. And then, and that would be it. That would be how you... Because you would need, obviously, the film would need, Stefan would have to have a love interest.
Yeah.
I like that.
I had no problem violating your real life as an individual who was engaged and married.
Yeah.
And you had a girlfriend and fiance, and we paid no mind to that. And I believe in the movie, you would fully end up together. Yeah. As you did on your last show.
Yeah.
Yeah,
which was the most cinematic romance I'm ever going to be a part of.
That was just beautiful.
It was great.
Yeah, I it's like you never think like, oh, I bet two people running in a graduate parody, will make you cry, and you guys running down the aisle was fantastic.
Well,
and I was at your real wedding.
Yeah,
and I'm not going to make a comparison.
Well, I remember being
your wedding
because it started live, that sketch, and then went to pre-tape and then ended live.
That's right. You ran back in.
And Bill and I were standing backstage watching the pre-tape.
Where?
Through the doors right by Lauren under the bleachers, through those double doors. And we were watching it play, and we had to run back in holding hands. Now, we could have just started to run and held hands. We were not on camera yet, and yet we were holding hands while we watched. And this was Bill's last show.
Yeah.
And it was also Fred's last show and Jason's last show. And...
Oh, that wasn't... Right. Yeah.
But it was also... I knew I was leaving.
Right.
But I would come back for, I think, 10 more shows. But I knew... Right. At that point, I knew I was doing late night. So emotional. And we were both tearing up watching
it. Yeah.
And then I also, in my back of my head, was like, I'm getting married in 4 months. And I better be this emotional then. Now sets the
that
bar.
That was made and then in August... You had your second marriage.
I had my second marriage.
I'm now thinking about that you had to run across the floor.
Yeah.
Which if you ever even have tried to walk across the floor or like, sneak behind the update wall, like the potential of you guys biting it on the largest cords in the world and
giant cords and
concrete floor.
Like cameras that are always in the wrong place. The scariest...
Or the right place for the camera. Wrong place for
a person
moving around or moving a goat. Well, you once had to move a goat.
The scariest thing about hosting was I remember like introducing the music, Jenna, the stage manager, saying, after you say the name of the band, stay here.
Yes.
Because the camera's going to swing by.
Yeah.
and take your head off if you move.
Also, my inclination was to, as I said, Jack White, walk off. get out of the way and walk off camera.
We both hosted for the first time in the last calendar year.
Yeah.
My biggest takeaway was how I could not believe there was an experience to that show that I had not ever done that was so beyond my realm of what I predicted.
I will show my hand in that as a writer who got to work on a lot of things, I didn't think I knew everything, but I thought I knew everything.
So did I.
And I had never, I'd been on camera twice, but it was at the update desk. And when we were blocking, when I was hosting with Cards, I was a basket case. And it was like, don't look in the lens. Like, it was like all these things were like falling apart that I used to sit in the control room and be like, tell him to look down, lower his eye line, turn to him. Can we get Cards over there? If he's going to turn over there all the time, just have Cards there, because he didn't know where to look. I would be belittling great actors and great comedians. And I didn't realize, I said, when do I get to rewrite the stuff I wrote? And Mary Ellen Matthews or Lindsay Shuka said, oh, John, you're never going to rewrite it.
Yeah.
And I don't know if I texted you, but I spoke to you that week, and I texted Andy and Fred and Bill, and I said, individually, I was like, guys, I never knew how hard this was.
Yeah.
That you were writing the material, blocking it for cameras, trying to listen to see if it was getting a laugh, and not having time to rewrite it because, like, you're pulled into some black tie dinner that you didn't want to go to.
Yeah.
Like, I said to them, I'm so embarrassed to say I genuinely thought we had the harder job.
Yeah. There is a...
And we did not.
There is a host dinner on Tuesdays.
Yeah. But then there's sometimes shenanigans throughout the week.
Yeah. The host dinner, though, I would go to every week. And as a writer, that was not the best use of my time. But the purpose of the host dinner, I think, as constructed, is to make the host feel at home, let them get to know some of the cast members.
Yeah.
And it was such a waste of time for me. In that, I was like, you can't make me feel more comfortable.
Right.
We all know this is a charade.
Right.
Why are we eating pasta when we all have to go back to work?
I never went to a host dinner until I hosted.
Yeah.
Were there good ones ever? Like,
sure.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Because you'd get a host to tell stories. Or
yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
There were super fun ones, and especially because they were also, I mean, there were some cast members that we were there with who were just like great dinner party people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Did cast members, without naming names, like ever order wrong? I that was always my fear if I went. That I'd be like, buttermilk pancakes?
No. The restaurant we go to has the like sorbets that are actually in the fruit. So like if you order like a mandarin orange, it's like half an orange.
Yeah, yeah, it's in it.
So some of that would look dumb when it came to the table. If you know.
I would not order dessert. I was talking to Pete Davidson about this phenomenon. I don't know if you've experienced it, but I'm comfortable saying that. I think he'd be comfortable with this. Lauren does not have to pee even throughout a 3.5 hour dinner. Not once. And there was a dinner in Chicago once. I think I got up 5 times.
I
wasn't sick or nothing.
Yeah. It is that thing where you start thinking you're doing drugs.
Yeah.
Even though you know you're not.
Oh, I'd love them to think I'm doing drugs.
Yeah.
Then it'd be like, that guy's danger. Put him on. I was just like, just filled with Pellegrino. And I was like, guys, I can't believe I'm saying this because I just went 30 minutes ago, but I'm going again.
That, I think we probably, like, just out of nerves or like hydrating more than Lauren.
Yes.
The other thing about Lauren, which is his ability to walk.
Oh, yeah.
Just walk. And when we worked on, Hot Rod in Vancouver, Lauren would say like once a week, let's go for a walk. I mean, he wouldn't. This is going back to an earlier thing. Someone would call you and say, do you want to go for a walk with Lauren?
Yeah.
And then you'd meet him at the walk point.
Right.
But I walked so much with Lauren, I had back issues.
You got back issues from those walks?
Yeah. And I went to see a chiropractor and they were like, have you been doing anything differently? And I said, I've been going for like 5 mile walks. And they said, oh, you have to stop doing that. And I was like, I'm doing it with a much older man who's fine.
Who's fine. And it's not... Lauren's in very good shape, and so, but I don't want to portray it as power walking.
Oh,
it's
no.
It's slow walking, and it's like museum walking.
Yes.
And so I think, based on the conversation and the fact that you walk side by side, because it's, you know, it's a quiet conversation discussing everything under the sun. So it's just a slower, more deliberate walk.
It's probably like that, a constitutional. Or...
Yeah. And when he got a Fitbit, then it became like the walk isn't over. We're not at 10,000. I love the walks, by the way.
I love the walks, too.
But I, you know, I have a tear in my hip and my feet. I kind of duck walk naturally. So I'm always afraid, like, sharing a small Beverly Hills sidewalk with him. I can sense he's like, why is this guy f***ing like this?
I realize now maybe the back issue is you're walking side by side with someone, and I was looking at him far more than he was looking at me.
Oh, yeah. I guarantee you he wasn't looking at you. I really do love walking with him. And we were in Beverly Hills. Three quick stories. We walked by that bench. You know, right on Santa Monica, there's like a sign that says Beverly Hills.
Yes.
And like neighborhoods don't normally have that. But and then there's like benches. And they're not for a bus. It's just benches. We were walking by the benches, and we hear a voice go, Lauren Michaels! This woman takes off her sunglasses and goes, Bette Midler! And he goes, hi, Bette, how are you? And this is John, you know, this is John Mulaney, and she's very nice, and I met her, very nice to meet you. And she was with her husband, I believe, who was wearing like a blue painter's smock, such that Eugene Lee, the wonderful set designer, might wear. Details. So she goes, we're taking a break. Are you walking? And he goes, yeah. She goes, you going to take a break? And he goes, no. She goes, well, you get sore, don't you? He goes, no. She goes, you don't get sore. You're telling me you don't get sore? And he goes, no, I don't get sore. And she didn't believe him. Last time I was walking with him, we were walking on one of those streets where like the plants that these rich people plant, like that curl over the sidewalk. And I was like crouched down because I was just being hit with like, birds of paradise and palm fronds and stuff. And we get to a tree, and he just sides up to the tree, and he goes, is that Randy Newman? And we see this guy getting out of his car. We're just watching this man who was not Randy Newman. Is that Randy? And like we're both talked on like the Miley Cyrus show when they're snooping. What was that show called?
Hannah Montana.
Hannah Montana, yeah, when they snoop. And like our heads were leaning out. He goes, could that be Randy? No, it's not Randy. And then we kept walking. And then at the end of that walk, it got dark because we've been walking for a long time. And we were under a street light. And we were just talking about life. It was a very nice conversation. And he said something to the effect of, we all become our fathers in some way. And he looked up and the street light hit him. And it was like a beautiful cinematic image. And I looked at him and I felt so much gratitude and love for everything he'd done. He'd really changed my life. And he was looking up, and then he pointed to a public bathroom, and he went, that's the bathroom where George Michael got arrested. And then we walked on.
My Lauren Flora story is that when we were doing...
A Florina story.
when we were doing MacGruber... my wife is from New Mexico, which is where MacGruber shot. And so... one night while we were there, my wife said we should have everybody from the movie over to my parents' house, and we'll get like really good Tex-Mex food. And so Lauren came over, and Lauren, which he does in the summer, Lauren wears shorts, which is maybe not in LA, but he was wearing shorts.
I don't think I've seen it, but yeah, okay.
And it's a little jarring.
Sure. I mean, people know, dig on him. I mean, when I wear shorts or a baseball cap, people just openly go like, no, you can't. No.
And Lauren bumped into a cactus.
Oh, no.
And a potted cactus at my wife's house. And it was
indoor?
Just outdoors. Like, but it was like a beautiful day. So it was just watching how no one knew what to do. You just think you're ready for everything in life, but no one knew what to do when Lauren bumped into a cactus.
Yeah. Imagine having that much respect that no one knows what to do.
Yeah.
When you bump into a cactus, you take the Sharpies out. Take the sharp points.
But he but it was also as the most Lauren reaction to what I'm assuming was a really painful thing of like, "Oh.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
That's fantastic."
Yeah. Oh.
You know, I started dating my wife my second season at the show, and she would come on Saturdays, but the nature of the production and the after party and all that, and as we fell more in love, I kind of would go to the after parties less and go home with her. And so she didn't really meet Lauren for probably 3 years, which I don't mean that he was rude or anything. It was just the nature of it. They never really intersected. And their first conversation is one of my favorite conversations ever because it made me realize that my wife Anna and Lauren have a lot in common, which is they're comfortable with silence and they do not care what you think of them. And they're friendly, they're kind, but like you might have to break through a layer. They were sitting next to each other. He was the head of the table, and I sat down, and she was sitting next to me but closer to him. And he turned to her, and he went, "Do you love New York?" And she went, "Best city in the world." And he said, "That's for sure." And now they really get along great.
Alexi loves Lauren. Like they
Anna loves Lauren.
Well, and I think—
We saw Paul Simon his last concert, and like Lauren— pulled the chair out, and he's like, no, John, sit back there. She's going to sit next to me. A better view.
That's great. She, in that way that I think is really intimidating, when you bring somebody into that SNL world and you bring them to after parties and there's a lot going on, like, Lauren always was really nice to Alexi.
Yeah.
In a way that she, like, not everybody had the bandwidth to be as nice to her as they probably should have, and he always did.
There's a phenomenon where if you're in entertainment and you have a significant other, people will might be more inclined to talk to the person in entertainment and not pay too much attention to their significant other. I think it runs male and female, but I think it unfairly skews towards female significant others. And I don't know why I'm so carefully choosing my words. Everyone understands what I'm talking about. But Lauren and Anna have a kinship and a relationship to me, which is similar, which is these are two Jewish people whose approval I want so much and who could not give a what yeah. anyone thinks of them. And then the other two people who just melted my heart at an SNL after party were Danny DeVito, who Anna really wanted to meet because we watched Always Sunny together. And he had come on when Charlie Day, he was in the Charlie Day monologue, right?
Yeah.
I said, "Do you want to meet Danny DeVito?" She was like, "Yeah." And oh, by the way, Danny DeVito showed up that week having dyed his hair bottle blonde. And when I say his hair, you know what the amount of hair I'm talking about. And he's in a booth in like the middle. And I went, "Danny, can I introduce you to my girlfriend?" And he goes, "Yeah." And like I'd spent the week with him and it was friendly. But, you know, he gets, you know, like everybody out, you know. And he comes up and he goes, "How you doing? I'm Danny." And she goes, "I think you're so funny." And goes, "What do you think of the blonde?" And she goes, "I think it looks really good. I used to be a hairstylist when I first moved to the city." And he was like, "What? No, I worked in a hair salon for my sister Angie. I couldn't get work, so I needed to work for Angie." I go, "No, I don't want people to think I'm a hairstylist." And Angie go, "You don't have any money." And they like talked. It was great. The other was Elton John, who I said, same thing, middle of a booth. You can imagine Elton John.
Yeah.
I said, "Can I introduce you to my girlfriend?" Because I'd spent with that monologue, I kind of hung out with Elton that week. Yeah. And he came out and he gave her, he just grabbed her and he kissed her on both cheeks. And then he straightened my tie.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
That's as good of a place to end as any, although I feel like we go on
Did
for hours and hours.
Did I interrupt you?
No, I don't think so. We'll edit it out. If he was, anytime John interrupted me, let's just try to.
No,
well, let's
think of how much we're not saying. Isn't that fun?
I want everybody at home to know there's so much more we haven't said.
Do you know how deeply we're looking into each other's eyes, communicating
the people we've
what
left
not to
out?
Say?
I do want to mention real quick, Documentary Now will have premiered.
Yes, Feb 20.
Yeah, Feb 20. Today is Feb 14, I think, as we're doing this. I think sometimes it's nice to timestamp for people who's listening. I am very excited for people to watch this season of Documentary Now.
Yes.
One of the things most interesting to me is there's still this show that we work on together. That makes me so happy.
Yeah, and work in the same way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We do work the same way.
Yeah. Late.
Late. We turn it in late. But late and great, I'd like to say.
Late and great, but it's funny outside of Saturday Night Live to just assure and guarantee people, like, it's gonna be fine.
Yeah.
They're like, "We need instruments." Like, it happens, baby. It all will happen. And they're like, "We don't know where this is set." And it's like, it's gonna be somewhere.
It's going to be and by the way, 6 months from now, it's going to be on TV.
Neither do I. It's going to be somewhere, man. I haven't written it.
All right, buddy. I'm going to see you tonight. I love you.
I'll see you tonight. I love you.
All right.
All right. Bye, Seth.
Bye.
Late Night with Seth Meyers airs weeknights on NBC at 12:35, 11:35 Central. Original music on the Late Night podcast is by the HE Band. Don't forget to follow the handle Late Night Seth on social media and tell your friends to subscribe to the Late Night podcast wherever they get their podcasts.
Murder on My Mind, a new podcast available exclusively on Wondery Plus, explores the circumstances leading up to the murder of two young men and the mistrials of the man accused of killing them. Up-and-coming rapper YNW Melly gained notoriety in the hip-hop world for his shocking lyrics and criminal exploits. When two of his best friends were gunned down in a drive-by shooting, investigators suspected the young rapper staged the scene. But after not one, but two trials that ended in hung juries and new evidence that may place YNW Melly at the scene of the crime, his trial has been paused indefinitely. With countless twists and turns, Law & Crime covers all angles of the case and begs the question, is this young artist the victim of a witch hunt or a silver-tongued devil who's evil to the core? Listen to Murder on My Mind exclusively and ad-free on Wondery Plus. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.